This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Today on Dreamland, we have a guest who has been on just a couple of shows. We'll find out how many, not many. He is an experiencer who's just beginning to come out with an extraordinary story. He's going to be at the MUFON Symposium in Cincinnati this year, and his story will be told there. It's going to be told in part here, right now. I want to welcome Eric Nansteel to Dreamland. You recorded with Ancient Aliens, and that's where I got your name, actually. They said it was one of the most extraordinary stories they had ever recorded.
Yeah, I'm thrilled that they think so.
Well, also, you're going to be a major figure at the MUFON Symposium.
Yes, I was told by the investigator who first interviewed me that I was chosen from among more than 8,000 cases last year in their top four, but my case was chosen first by unanimous vote among their team. And so I'm excited. I'll be there.
Okay. And Eric is also writing a memoir, which he hopes to have with him when he's there. He's got 36,000 words, I think he said. And you have miles to go before you sleep. Being a writer myself, I can assure you the blank page is waiting for you. But don't ignore it. You do it, because it's an important and extraordinary story. All right, let's explore into it a little bit. We'll start with your mother, because you're what? You're 55 years old, right?
56.
56. Oh, well, another year has passed. That happens to me every year, too, for some strange reason.
Yeah.
It's a multi-generational situation, as so many of us have.
Yes.
I think my father had contact. My uncle obviously did. He was at Wright Field and involved with the work on the Roswell debris. So, yeah, I mean, it's in my family. But how is it in your family? Where does it come from?
When I first started to tell my mother and father about my experiences, which started in 2020 on a regular basis, it triggered some memories that my mother had that she talked about. She never told me this story before, but when she was 9 years old in 1953, she was sitting in her kitchen with her mother and little brother when two of her older brothers ran in from outside. Now, they lived in the suburbs of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in a little lower middle class suburb named Turtle Creek, Pennsylvania. And they live on the top of a hill looking down into a valley where there's a train yard. And a UFO appeared above the train yard. It was spinning and it had lights. And her brothers saw it, and it zipped off, like went really fast, really high up and left. And her brother saw it and came inside and told my mother and my grandmother what had happened. That would have been the end of it, except that night my mother had an experience. She woke up in the middle of the night. She shared a bedroom with five siblings because they were poor. And she woke up in the middle of the night and she felt like she just had to go check on something down in the coal cellar. And back then, their cellar was no place for a 9-year-old girl to go in the middle of the night. It had a bricked up entrance to an old coal mine where they used to get their coal to heat the house with. It was just a dirty little dugout room with laundry machines. So she slid out of bed silently, walked downstairs past her parents' bedroom into the kitchen and opened the basement door and started walking down the stairs. And the kitchen light reach down to the end of the stairs and no further. So it was shadowed beyond the base of the stairs, and there was something stirring in the shadows. And
Staring up at her?
Yeah, well, she didn't know what it was at first, but by the time she got down to about the fourth step, two angry, growling, barking German shepherds lunged at her, came up the stairs and lunged at her, and she was frozen. She couldn't move. She was paralyzed, and we know what that's like.
The
family did have a dog, but it was like this big, and it was named Fuzzy. And you wouldn't confuse a dog like that for two large German shepherds. And I told her about how, in my experiences, I've had what Freud would call screen memories. I call them something else, but...
What do you call them?
Well, I believe they're post-hypnotically induced. So I call them post-hypnotic veils, how they disguise themselves.
Interesting phrase. I think we all live behind post-hypnotic veils, all of us who have been in this experience, and that means a lot of people who don't know they were ever in it.
Yeah, it's designed to help you dismiss your experience as a dream that doesn't make sense, so you wouldn't think too much about it. But yeah. I told her about your barn owl in the window story from Communion, because I remembered that story like from 30 years ago when I read it.
Wait a minute, let's go back to what happened, because she was on the stairs with the two German shepherds barking at her. Yeah. We can't leave that behind. We got to go back there. What happened next?
Well, she lost consciousness when they lunged at her. And so they came up toward her. She lost consciousness. And sometime later, she woke up back in her bed. She doesn't know whether she walked herself back to bed or what happened. And I told her it could be that she was abducted. I mean, it coincides with the UFO video, but if I hadn't had my experiences, I would not have suggested that to her.
It's interesting because, you know, the way it happened, it was so anomalous in the sense that they had no German shepherds.
Right. And ever since, she has had a deathly fear of German shepherds since that day.
Doesn't that make you think how many things we fear for no apparent reason? Do you suppose those are all indications of contact?
Well, I wonder. I do, in the context of what I've been through and one other incident that my mother reported to me.
Yeah, go ahead.
In the early 1970s, when I was very young, when I was having my own experiences with glowing orbs coming in, and we'll talk about that in a bit, coming at me when I was a baby and a toddler, my mother was having dreams about being chased by UFOs through the neighborhood. And this was before any major blockbusters came out. This was like 4 years before... Close Encounters of the Third Kind came out, 8 years before E.T., the Extraterrestrial, came out. And in that time, the only thing that might have been in the public zeitgeist about this subject was a 1969 show called Project UFO, which was kind of based on Project Blue Book. So there was nothing on TV or popular television, and my mother hated science fiction anyway. So she's not the kind of person to think about science fiction. But yeah. She had dreams of being chased by UFOs through the neighborhood, and every time she got into another neighbor's backyard to try to get away from it, it got closer and closer and closer. And then she loses consciousness once it hovers over her. And so I take that as... something out of her subconscious mind is trying to express itself to her that she's suppressing something.
She's trying to cope with the fear, a fear that she can't understand and can't cope with. And I get where she's coming from and what's happening to her. What's happening to those of you on the free side right now is we're going to take a little break and we'll be right back.
Okay.
We're talking to Eric Van Steele. Eric is a close encounter witness of some note. He's going to be on Ancient Aliens soon. We'd probably, you haven't been given a schedule yet, I wouldn't guess.
Two or three weeks.
Okay, so it's going to be fairly soon. In fact, I might be on that same show. I think they interviewed me for it too. So it'll be a few weeks anyway, folks. You'll see him on Ancient Aliens. He's going to be at the MUFON Symposium in Cincinnati. I was invited. Unfortunately, I can't make it this year. I would love to go, but I cannot. And so, or maybe I can manage to change my schedule somehow. You never know. In any case, let's go back to your mom, and she's had the what I would consider a direct experience, probably, with the Greys in the basement when she was how old?
She was 9 years old in 1953.
So she has this experience. It's a very weird screen memory, because most of the screen memories are like my screen memory, or you probably will be talking about some too, of an owl. And hers is of these German shepherds seemingly attacking her. But that's enough to where she wouldn't remember what really happened.
Yeah.
That was the purpose of that. And so then she's trying to cope with this, but having these recurring dreams of being chased by UFOs.
Yeah, that was 20 years later when she was having those dreams.
Right. You get the depth of the trauma here, folks. With it's 20 years later, she's still trying to cope with this. What's her situation now?
Well, she makes it clear to me that she doesn't actively believe that she's an abductee, but she does find it intriguing, my interpretation of her experiences. But since I was telling her about screen memories, that's what triggered those memories for her and why she told me her story. I believe they were coming for her in the early 70s also. And I'll tell you why. But because I was having experiences in the early 70s, and I believe they were bothering the both of us at the same time over a 4-year rotation.
We're going to get into your experiences in a moment. Let's talk a little bit about your family history. Where you come from? Do you know your blood type?
I'm not 100% certain, but I think I may be positive. And so I'm not an Rh negative blood type.
Yeah, I'm an O positive myself, a super common blood type.
Well, my mother has green eyes, and I've heard that might be significant.
I don't know. I don't think we know enough to really make any decisions about blood types or eye color or anything like that. Because, you know, a lot of the close encounter witnesses and abductees I know are black, and they don't have green eyes ever. I know.
Barney Hill, famous case.
Barney Hill is. And yeah, but it's very underground in the black community, because people are, you know, they have enough trouble being black. You don't want to be black and being taken aboard flying saucers. That does not help you. So the ones I know are very private about their experiences, but they're there definitely. So they're in the, you know. So therefore, I don't really, eye color doesn't mean much to me. And we tried to do a study at one point about blood types, and unfortunately, most people don't know their blood type. So we paid for about 10 or 15. Blood typings, and then Ann and I realized they were all over the lot. We weren't getting anything. Okay. So we decided we're not going to spend any more money on this. We've already spent about 10 grand. And so if someone wants to look at the genetics of the abductees, maybe that will happen someday, but I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. Okay. So let's go on now. Your mother had apparently had experiences. She does not kind of buy into it, but at the same time, it sounds like she probably should buy into it.
Well, she believes what I know happened to me. She believes me.
Yeah.
And I tell her.
But she doesn't want to. She does not want to own it for herself. Probably yeah. meaning it was very traumatic.
But, yeah, I sometimes I wish I didn't know about it. So
well, let's begin to talk about you. We're going to move on to 1970. You're a little boy at this point. How old are you in 1970?
Well, I turned 12 months old in January in 1970.
But, okay.
But my the experience that I remember, the first orb that I saw was in March or April.
Well, let's not jump ahead.
Okay.
Let's go to that first moment.
Okay.
You're a little boy, a little baby, actually.
Yeah.
What do you, this, we're going to your first memory of this.
Yeah. One of my very earliest memories. Well, I was living in Des Plaines with my family, and I was in my bedroom. I don't remember what day it would be, but all I remember was it was in the morning, the sun was coming in. My mother had not come in to get me yet. But there was the sun coming into the window a little bit. And I was standing up in my crib, holding onto the side rail. I was 15 months old. I wouldn't remember any of this, but I remember the layout of the room. I remember the playful mobile hanging from the ceiling. I remember where the diaper changing station was. And I remember everything. But I was looking at my closet door and a bright white orb of glowing plasma just comes right through the door like it's not even material. And it crosses the room slowly about the pace of an adult walking. And it reaches my forehead and I pass unconscious. And this happened to me many times over the next 4 years.
So this, let me explore this area of your life a little bit. Do you remember, because you understand, you're talking about something that unfolded during childhood amnesia, the time of life we don't normally remember.
That's exactly right. I don't remember much from that period of my life.
But this was obviously an extremely memorable event, and understandably so. I mean, God, it's quite an unusual thing.
I might have forgotten about it if it didn't happen several times.
Well, exactly. I was just going to get to that.
Okay.
Let me ask you this. Did you ever have anything like synesthesia with the sunlight, hear it talking to you or anything like that?
No. No neurological issues. No mental health diagnoses.
Yeah. Well, the reason I ask is that there are some close encounter witnesses who I sort of differentiate from abductees. Abductees are people who are taken. A lot of people don't have that experience or don't remember it anyway. What they have are encounters. So far, you're just a close encounter witness. That's going to change later in the show, though, folks. And you're a little tiny boy, and this orb comes to you. Do you have any... And it becomes kind of part of your life. Does anyone else ever see it?
Nobody in my family reported seeing anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Meaning that you're now isolated. It's part of your own experience. Do you feel it? Do you recall feeling that sense of isolation with this when you were a little one? Did you talk about it? Do you remember?
Yes, when I was old enough to talk. Because it was happening up until the age of five. In 1974, when I was five, I was talking about it to my mother, and she said, "Oh, those must be angels. You know, you're special, whatever." And, you know, so I was content with that explanation for much of my life. I'm special. Angels visit me. I'm cool. I now take those experiences in the context of what we're talking about.
So you are off the angel explanation, obviously.
No, very much so. Yes.
Okay, let's unpack that very much so a little bit. Why so definitely not angels?
Because I take it in a referential context of what my mother experienced in the same period of time with those strange dreams about the UFOs, with the UFO sighting and possible abduction she had in 1953, with so many other things that happened to me starting in the 90s and then again in the 2020s. I've watched several documentaries of abductees that have also experienced those glowing orbs of plasma entering their room and coming at them, and then they're rendered unconscious. So as soon as I saw people talking about that, this all fits. This is all connected. It goes all the way back to almost my birth. So that's how I connected it. And later on, I talked to Linda Moulton Howe. And when I was telling her details about my orbs, and I told her that, it would come through my closet door, or sometimes the wall, sometimes the ceiling, but usually like through the closet door, which is weird. And she's like, Eric, as soon as you mentioned that the orbs came through your closet door, that's when I knew you were telling the truth, because I've heard the same detail from other people that never talked about it in public. And I'm like, really? Wow. I mean, this is huge. I mean, I like to, this is why I want to connect to the community, because I want to understand this phenomenon. So I want to understand it through the eyes of other people. And the more we learn collectively, the better.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me ask you this. What is your line of work? What do you do for a living?
I'm an art director and graphic designer.
And you work in the advertising business, perhaps, or?
Well, yes, I work at the moment in a marketing department for a national product distributor. And
I see. Yeah. So it's a straightforward kind of a job. But I want you to tell me what you see the lay of the land being right now out there.
People are becoming more receptive toward hearing stories like ours. People would catch me writing in my memoir and ask me what I'm writing. And I want to say, oh, that's private, but then I'd sound like a dick, and I don't want to do that.
Well, it's not private if you're going to publish it.
No, I know, but, it's...
I know how it could... I hate it when people tell, what's your book? What are you writing about when I'm writing? I don't talk about it when I'm writing, because it sucks. You suss up the energy, and I'm not going to talk about your memoir either for that reason.
Oh, okay.
Just know that it's there, and Eric will certainly be back when it's published. Okay. We're not going to drop this. We're coming up on a break. Okay, we're going to take another brief break. We'll be right back. Okay, we're talking to Eric Nansteel, a close encounter witness. And let's get a little deeper here. Let's go beyond the orb period. Do you have any sense of, before we do that, do you have any sense of personality or any sense of relationship with these orbs you saw?
It was very abrupt every time they arrived. They would either come through the closet door. One time I was in the hospital and it came through the hallway door to my hospital bed. And I had an interesting experience the next morning after it visited me. But no, nothing in terms of personality. I don't know if these things are probes, drones, or cloaked grays. I have no idea what they are, but I believe they're related.
An interesting experience the next morning. Let's hear about that.
All right. Well, I had a roommate and I was in a Lutheran General Hospital in Park Ridge, Illinois. And I was in there for some tests related to a slight concussion that I had the year before. And before I had the concussion, I know what people are thinking. Before I had the concussion, these orbs are coming at me before that even happened. But when I was at the hospital, I was on my very last night there, and I was scheduled to go home. Everything was fine. I was fine. But they had done like EEGs and stuff just to check up on me, make sure that I'm not, you know, like have damage from what happened year before. And so the orb came to my bed and knocked me unconscious, but I had a roommate in the room with me, and his name was Tommy. I don't remember his last name. And Tommy was very, very sick. He had an infected abscess in his abdomen, and it was killing him. And he was scheduled for surgery the very next morning. And, you know, because they're going to go and take it out and, you know, try to, you know, save him. And so the morning that I was about to leave, my mother showed up, and she had a little toy car in her hand. And she said, "Eric, gather your things. Oh, here, and give this toy car to Tommy and say goodbye." And I said, Mommy, I don't want to talk to him." And she said, "Why don't you want to talk to him?" And I said, "Because he's going to die." Nobody told me he was going to die. I just knew that he was deathly ill. I just knew it was coming. And she said, "Eric, you have to say goodbye to him. It's a nice thing to do." And she was standing with Tommy's mother because they were saying their goodbyes by the doorway. I was 5 years old here. And so I walked over to Tommy's bed, and he had this little three wooden set of stairs to climb up into these beds. And so I climbed up the little stairs, and I got onto his bed with him. And I didn't do it to say goodbye. I just instinctively spread my hands open, put it on his torso, and started moving my hands up and down like this. And then I said, "There, now you're going to be all better." And I gave him his truck. I said goodbye. And my mom and Tommy's mom are looking at each other like, "What the hell is he doing?" But they exchanged numbers. And then I was running down the hallway later. I have magic hands. Well, my mother got a call about a week later from Tommy's mother. And I didn't learn about this for many years after, but she got a call from Tommy's mother, and she said, hours after the two of you left, Tommy was taken in for surgery, and the abscess was already gone, and that he didn't have to have surgery. And they sent us home later that day after some tests. And so my mom said, "Oh, you healed Tommy." But I never told her about the orb. So I think they're related. I've never had an experience like that again.
Have you tried to heal since?
My mother told me that I healed my grandfather, her father. It was that later that same year. Because he was dying of emphysema or COPD. I forget exactly what it was, but
he wanted. Thing.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm sorry. I don't know.
Yeah.
He was begging God for one more year. And so I went up and I put my hands on him, and he got his one more year. But I don't have that. And if I had it then, I don't have it now, because I get sick all the time.
Well, healers are notoriously unable to heal themselves.
Oh,
so you may still be able to heal others. You might try that.
I don't know. I never tried. I wasn't able to help my ex-wife. I wasn't able to help my daughter when they got sick. So
it's probably not with you anymore. It might be able to, if you talk to somebody who knows about healing, another healer, you might find that you can get it back again. I would at least explore it a little bit. Go ahead.
I take it in the context of these experiences. You know, I think they deserve the credit. The orbs, those are the grays. I think they were interested in me for some maybe genetic sequences that they like or something like that, or other abilities. I don't know, but I've heard of people having gifts when they're children, when they're innocent, and then losing it when they're older.
Yeah, that's not uncommon at all. So that's quite possible. But this is now, we're going to move on in terms of time, into some other areas of your life. What was kind of the next thing that happened? Because right now you're in a situation where your mother has been, had a very strange close encounter experience with the dogs. I mean, that's unusual. I've never heard of an experience. So I'm glad it never happened to me.
Well, you had the barn owl. I mean, come on, that's a screen memory.
What's that? The barn? Yeah, but a barn owl is not a couple of raging German shepherds. That was a really scary. My screen memory. Yeah, very much so. Was much less dramatic. What about you? Do you have screen memories?
Yes, but not until 2020. But I had an experience in 1994 where I saw grays. I don't know what you want to talk about first.
Let's sort of roll up. We're going to kind of roll through your life. So we're past the orb period. You have healed the little boy who's, did you keep in touch with him at all? Or
no, the one phone call that my mother received from Tommy's mother telling her that he was okay, that he didn't require surgery, he just got better. That was the last we heard of them. And I don't know his surname. I would love to see if he knows about that.
Well, maybe he'll watch this or listen to this or watch Ancient Aliens and reconnect with you.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. Did they talk about that on Ancient Aliens?
Gosh, no, I don't remember.
We'll have to see. I'll certainly be watching.
I didn't talk about the healing on Ancient Aliens.
Yeah. Anyway, okay, then this is the one chance. If he sees this, Tommy, get in touch with me, and I'll get you in touch with Eric for sure. And I'm easy to get in touch with, Whitley@Strieber.com. So, and if you do it, Strieber, Strieber, it still works.
Well, that's smart to have two. Yeah, exactly. Like that. Yeah, that's
smart. Exactly. Okay, so now, as you're growing up, mm-hmm. we're now past your, let's say you're not quite a young adult, but you're in your late childhood, early teens. What was occurring in those, at that period?
I have no recollections of unusual experiences during my teenage years. In fact, nothing really happened until 1994 when I was 25. But there was a time in the late 80s when I saw somebody's book on an end cap in a grocery store, and it spoke to me.
That's strange.
Your book, Communion, has an illustration on the front cover of a gray. It resembles one of the taller grays, not the little skinny bobs, but one of the taller ones. And I saw that illustration, and I was as spooked as I was curious. And I was not actively into ufology or abductions or anything like that. I hadn't even heard about Betty and Barney Hill or anything. My only knowledge of UFOs came from Hollywood at that point in the late 80s. So I saw your book, and it stirred. There was an emotional reaction to your front cover, and I had to. It was $5.02. It was on the end cap. I bought it. I absorbed that book cover to cover. And I was fascinated. And then when you came out with Transformation, I bought that book and I read that. You came out with Breakthrough. I I read that. And I was, and so it's a thrill for me to be here to talk to you. Finally, it's like, wow, I actually, yeah.
Thank you. That cover, I didn't know it at the time. I probably been terrified if I had, was the trigger for first contact between humanity and these other people. It's a it's a mnemonic trigger, a memory trigger. And that's exactly what it did to you. It activated hidden, buried memories. And that was apparently what it was supposed to do.
Right. But not memories I could articulate at that point.
Right. Well, that's another journey. And that's the journey you're on now.
Yes.
Your memoir is about those memories.
Yes.
And, you know, people think, oh, there are so many human beings in the world. But you have to understand that from the point of view of our visitors, every human life is huge and terribly important.
Yeah.
Everyone. They don't see us like as sort of a mass like we do. They see deeply into every individual as not only a person in this world, but a person who has traces in other worlds and a huge past that we have forgotten. They see us as very different from the way we see ourselves.
I suppose it has to be true. I don't know exactly what it means. You know,
neither do I. I wouldn't say I
know. Speak toward their agenda, and I only have suspicions. So.
Suspicions are interesting. What are they? What are your suspicions?
Well, this was the part I wrote the back of the book. The last two chapters are done because I was just wanted to get it out, my suspicions. But I believe, and this kind of aligns with something you said in a documentary I saw. I think you were talking to George Norrie or somebody, and you were saying how they want to join with us.
Yeah.
And that's why Anne came up with the name Communion for your book. And so I think what I suspect may be somewhat in line with what your comments on that. I think based on a lot of things, it's just like vague things that come into my head from what I read, from what I watch, impressions I get. But I've come to suspect a possibility that the tall grays, the ones in charge, the ones that are 7 feet tall, the ones I see most, you know, when I'm taken out of the house. When I'm not taken out of the house, it's just the little guys, you know, when they're just coming for collections. But when I am taken, it's the tall ones. I believe that they may have used cloning to survive changes in their planet's climate, and may have bred themselves out of the ability to procreate sexually. But also, you know, so that's one thing they want to fix. But also, they may have bred themselves out of the ability to host souls. They may have inadvertently turned themselves into biological machines of some kind. And they might want to breed themselves back into having that capability again, so that they could ascend to completion, the God consciousness, the reason why the universe even exists, which is to foster, to create and foster intelligent life, as you know, is it like the universe is a nursery, is how I see it. It's a culture medium for intelligent life. And I think they want to rejoin the soul cycle. And if that's the case, gosh, I know this is so esoteric and.
No, it's really hitting home. Go ahead.
Okay. So I think, based on my experiences and what I've heard, they're breeding themselves, a replacement species for Homo sapiens sapiens. That will be neurologically compatible so they can basically take their brains, their minds, their memories, their experiences, and place them in human hybrids and become compatible with living here on Earth on the surface. I think it's a very slow, calculated invasion of, you know, it starts as an infestation and then a replacement. So at some point, Homo sapiens sapiens would have to be phased out like we phased out Neanderthals. Or was that us? I don't know. But I think they aimed to replace us, and they stepped up their schedule when we started lighting off nuclear bombs in the 40s.
Wow. I'm kind of gobsmacked.
Well, it's
an awesome theory. I have to tell you that. I don't know if it's correct or any of the theories are correct, but that's one of the most interesting ones I've ever heard.
Can I add something to
it? Yes, of course.
Okay. I was once shown an image, a blank wall. It was like pewter gray wall that became a viewable screen. And I was shown images of all my offspring that they created from my tissues. And there must have been 18 or more of images. I remember three rows of images. Maybe there was like six or nine across and three deep. And they were of varying ages. And then later on, they showed me a live baby boy that was mine, that was taken from my ex-girlfriend, I believe. I don't know that. But he was crawling on a metal table. And I was becoming upset with them, with my abductors. And they wouldn't let me touch them. They wouldn't let me meet any of them. And so I asked them, where are these offspring? Where are my children? Where are they kept? And on that visit, again, there was a wall that became a screen. And they showed me a map of the contiguous 48 United States. And under Eastern Illinois, there are caverns. Now, I checked. There's no known caverns under Eastern Illinois. But they showed me. And these look like constructed caverns, but they're huge. Like enough material to account for the Panama Canal. I mean, it's just huge. And I could show you a map. I created a crude one. Graphically, but this is where they're kept. And I tell you, these caverns, they're probably a third of a mile down from the surface, maybe half a mile, but below that, it'd probably be too hot for habitation. But there's three of them. There's two near the surface running parallel with each other that slopes down at the southern ends. And then one between them, a little bit deeper, and they're running just west of the Indiana border. They started as far north as the bottom of Lake Michigan and went down to about where I'd guess Peoria would be in Illinois. And this is something I struggled to put in the book, because this is something testable. You know,
yeah, I was just going to say that it is testable.
You might be able to get a seismograph and send some sound waves into the ground and get a return and check for caverns or voids underground. And so, well, what if they showed me this thing and people go look for them, they don't find them, and then it's like, well, that throws Eric's credibility down the well.
But we all have that problem.
I decided to show ChatGPT a graphic of the caverns that I created that looked like the map I was shown, and I asked it to give me a forensic analysis of the feasibility of the caves, like what kind of rock is in the bedrock? Is that conducive to creating caves? Is it stable rock? You know, is this a good area of the country to dig caverns, and why so close to Chicago? So I just gave it all these questions, and it gave me an analysis, and it said this is a great place to put caverns because it's dolostone rock, which is high in magnesium content, very strong. It's not too difficult to dig through. It's in a geologically low activity area, so there's like very few, if any, earthquakes. It's perfect. And then it went through the actual design of the caverns and broke down step by step why the design of the caverns is actually a very good design for creating a base. And now this is not something I could come up with in my imagination in some kind of a fever dream. I just saw what I saw and I just reported it. And then ChatGPT gives me this whole forensic and geological analysis and say, this is actually, you know, feasible. And this is actually a good design. And so I included that in the book for what it's worth.
We're going to take another brief break. But it's not going to be the usual kind of break. It's going to be a little bit different, folks, because you're not going to get rid of me. I want to talk to everybody, the subscribers who are listening, as well as the ones listening on the free side. The site is becoming extremely important. You're never going to hear anything like this on another site for the simple reason that there is no other close encounter witness with a podcast like this, and with the experience I've had and the ability to have this kind of a conversation. So I'm really doing two things here. First, I urge you subscribers to go out there and get your friends interested in unknowncountry.com and see if you can't get them to join us. Second, especially if they're close encounter witnesses, because we've got a wonderful community going on the site. It's sort of a mini Facebook in that sense. Those of you who are not subscribers, please try to make yourself step up or tell your friends about the show. Tell them to come to YouTube to the show, because that helps us too a little bit. Go to the site, go to unknowncountry.com. And get a paid subscription. $4.95 a month buys you so much material. It is so valuable. Now let's go back to Eric. Okay, Eric, I've done a spiel here. I hope it helps, because this is an expensive process, and I've been spending more money on Unknown Country in this than I make. If I didn't have my books weren't successful, I would have to close everything down. So let's keep going. Now, you have talked about children. This means that you have had the same exact experience I have had and others. You've had semen extracted from you.
Many times.
Well, I only remember once, thank goodness. But the result of it is also extremely sad in my case. But I've written about that, and I've talked about that, and we don't need to talk about that today. But any listeners who are curious, just write me at Streber.com, Whitley@Streber.com, and I'll gladly give you some information of where to go to find out more about my story. But we're talking about Eric's story today. So, Eric, knowing that, you know, I know you're telling the truth about this because it happened to me. Can you tell us a little bit about what that was like, especially like the first time you remember it happening?
My very first experience seeing grays, the little skinny bob types, was in 1994. It was Saturday, August, I forget, it was like the third Saturday of August. 1994. And I was laying in bed, and it was maybe about 6:30 in the morning. The sun was just coming into the window, and I had come out of a deep black sleep into a dream state where I was aware that I was asleep. So it was a lucid dream. And I was able to like decide if I wanted to have a dream, like a fun dream, or wake up. But I had plans that day that I was excited about, so I decided to wake up. So I tried to open my eyes and I couldn't. And as soon as I realized I wasn't able to forcefully wake myself up, something, a dream image was like put in my head. It didn't come from me. It was an image of a green maple leaf with the sun above it shining down through it. You can see the gossamer structure of the leaf and the cells and the veins. And I was spinning underneath this leaf, and it was meant to dazzle me and distract me, I believe. I knew this wasn't a dream from my imagination, and it freaked me out because it wasn't mine. And so I started to wake up more but not be able to open up my eyes. And then suddenly my ears started to work, and then I could hear my floor fan running because I like to have the white noise when I'm sleeping. So I heard the white noise of the floor fan, and then I could hear like the rustling of fabric brushing against fabric on both sides of my bed. Like I, you know, there was someone in my room. And I know this sounds like it could be an episode of sleep paralysis, but I'll tell you what happened. So I started to panic because I felt vulnerable. I felt like I wasn't alone. And I'm, you know, your bedroom's supposed to be your fortress. You know, you're supposed to be untouchable so you can rest. And I felt very vulnerable. And so I started to panic and I started to shake, trying to open my eyes. And my bed was undulating under me as I'm trying to wake up. And then finally I won the battle and I opened my eyes. I sit up, I shoot up straight like to a sitting position. And I could see and feel the movement like going around the bed. So as fast as I could turn my head to the left, I saw four of them, whoosh, 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 whoosh. 3.5 feet tall, big bulbous heads, big black eyes. They're wearing a dark one-piece garment from neck to foot. And they were not running. They were not walking. They were propelled faster than any little thing with legs like that could possibly move. It was as if they were on the taut end of a bungee cord that was like allowed to snap. And that's how they accelerated, like whoop, whoop, whoop. Like, and then right through my door, like it wasn't even there. And I was agape. What was it? What did I just see? And that's what that was like. And I was too afraid to pursue because what if they were still in the apartment? I had a roommate at the time, but he wasn't home. He was a traveling forklift repair technician, and he was out on assignment. So I couldn't go in there and ask, hey, did you see these guys?
Yeah.
I was alone, but I called my father, and I told him about it within hours, and he just said, whoa. But he didn't, you know, what do you say to that?
What do you say to that? Exactly. That's one of the horrible experiences. Part of this experience is when you tell people about these things, and they can be very, very emotionally disturbing to you. They don't know how to react, and they can't really relate. And speaking of relating, folks, we've come to the end of the free part of the show. And so I would, as always, urge you to subscribe so you can listen to the whole thing and go to Unknown Country and get all of its extraordinary and valuable information. No place like it in the world. Literally the largest site of its kind on planet Earth. And you can get it for $5 a month. How can you go wrong? Thank you very much for being with us, as always, on Dreamland.
And subscribe, because I haven't even gotten to the good stuff yet. Oh, but thank you.
Okay, now it's time to get to the good stuff. If you haven't already, completely blown a few minds, more than a few. Have there been, you have mentioned that you have at times been taken.
Oh, yes. Yeah, definitely.
Let's talk about that, because it's time now.
All right. Well, we can start with the first encounter starting in 2020 that I remember. But there's a buildup to that. If you don't mind, I'll just do a little buildup.
Of course. Yeah, you're here to do this. And yeah, in your way. I mean, I'm here as an organizing observer. That's my job.
Starting in February and March of 2020, I started to notice things were different in my bedroom between when I'd go to bed at night and when to wake up in the morning. Things that were misplaced, things that I did not misplaced myself. One of the more notable ones was I went to bed with earplugs, you know, because sometimes my daughter will make noise before she goes to bed, and I didn't want it to wake me up. Or sometimes one of my Airbnb guests would use the bathroom and slam the door or something. So I wear the earplugs so I can sleep. And I woke up in the morning and my earplugs aren't there. And I'm like, oh, I must have taken them out. Because usually in the middle of the night, if they become uncomfortable, I'll pull them out and I'll throw them onto the nightstand, right? But then I turned my head to look for my earplugs. And I was expecting to see them just like 4 or 5 inches apart. Maybe one of them rolled off onto the floor or something, because I'm always throwing them. And they were sitting very politely, very daintily placed next to each other on the dresser next to me. And I'm like, I didn't do that. So that was weird. It's like, why are they stacked so neatly next to each other on their ends? It's like, I'm not going to wake myself up enough in the middle of the night to so that was the first clue. Another clue is I woke up in the morning and my bed clothes, my comforter, which has big black and gold stripes on it, were 90 degrees in the wrong direction, as though the bed had been stripped and then it was put back over me the wrong way. And not only that, but I normally have things that I put on top of the comforter. I have a back scratcher and I have a sleep mask. And it's always on top of the comforter, because if it was under the comforter, I'd roll onto it and it's got a sharp edge and that would bother me. So I always have it on the top. But if I ever had a fitful night, it always gets knocked off to the side and like it would fall on the floor or something on the other side of the bed. But this time it was neatly placed next to me side by side under the top sheet. And again, I know myself, I did not do that. So I started to have suspicions like, somebody's coming to my bedroom. What is this? This wasn't me. I know my anatomy. So I decided to do an experiment. Back in 1994, when I had that experience with the grays running out of my room, I did not yet consider myself an abductee. I thought that was a one-off experience, and I didn't connect it with the orbs in the early 70s. So I decided to do a test. I wanted to communicate with whatever's coming into my room. And I thought, well, what if it's those things from 1994? So I went online and I found a graphic, what we now know as Skinny Bob, the short grays. And I put it on a 8.5 by 11 sign. And I put, let me remember you. I want to remember your visit. I will not harm. And I put this on the wall above my headboard. And for 2 weeks, nothing happened. I started to even forget that the sign was there. I even felt sheepish about putting it up in the beginning, because what if somebody goes into my room, they see that on the wall?
Exactly.
It's like, what are you, weird? So after 2 weeks, you know, I go to bed and I woke up in the middle of the night in my garage. I was not standing. I was leaning forward at a 30-degree angle, suspended off my feet above the concrete floor of my garage.
Oh, my God.
And I was looking at my Chevy Trailblazer, my red Chevy Trailblazer that I owned at the time. This is 5 years ago, was right next to me. And then there was a small gray, one of the little skinny bobs with the big bulbous head and the big black eyes. Tiny little nose, little slitty mouth.
Yeah, those are the ones I have all of their anatomy in my new book, The Fourth Mind.
Great, awesome.
All the details. So yeah, go ahead.
So it was dark in the garage, except there was a side window that Skinny Bob was standing next to the side window, and there was streaming light coming in, illuminating him on one side, and it looked like the light was kind of like moving or dancing, as though there was like a light source outside the window of the garage, and it was lighting him up. And I'm hovering maybe 8 inches off the ground, and I'm leaning forward at a 30-degree angle, paralyzed. all I could do was move my head a little bit. And I couldn't talk. It was as if my expressive speech was as paralyzed as the rest of my body. And I was just, it was as if I was just there to observe and listen. And this thing spoke to me with words in my mind. It was like his words entered my brain. And he said, "We can't let you remember our visit or else my superiors will know about it." And then about 2 seconds after that, before I could formulate a question, I was unconscious again. And then I eventually woke up in my bed back in my house. So I was taken.
Yeah. So typical of them. They tell you they can't let you remember while they're letting you remember. That tells me this is a real memory, because no one would know to do. I know how they think because I've been with them so much and have read all these letters and so forth. I know a lot about how they think, as much as anyone ever has in the world. And I'm telling you, that's how they think. They told you, "We can't allow you to remember this while allowing you to do it." It's the same way my first experience with them in my adult life happened in the 70s when I was taken to this school. I didn't even know anything about this at the time. And I wanted to enter the school and become matriculated in this school because it was a million years old and it just sounded like the most fascinating possible university you could go to. Mm-hmm. And I was told as I was entering it that I wasn't ready yet and I couldn't enter. Hmm. And I ended up back at home.
But they showed it to you. That's
well, see, no, this it's deeper than that. I'm in it now. Mm. I've been in it ever since then. That was the beginning of my whole life experience with them.
Okay.
So they said, "You're not ready." And that was the moment I actually entered this university of this life. And they said to you, "We can't allow you to remember it while allowing you to remember it." It's the same way of doing things.
This was the first conscious encounter of many over the next 4 years.
So if you... They say we can't allow you to, and then they start exactly how they work.
But I think the reason might have had something to do with my very next visit.
Great, tell us the story.
As he said, because my superiors will know about it. I think the very next visit, one of the superiors showed up in my bedroom. So, and they always come in fours. They always come at me in fours, not ones, not twos and four, but fours. So the one in the garage must have had the other three nearby and I just didn't see them. But the very next week, just 1 week later, which is uncharacteristic for them because normally they come every 4 to 6 weeks when they're doing your 4 year rotation.
Wait a minute. Talk about the 4 year rotation.
Every 20 years they come for 4 years. And it's about monthly for 4 years. And they do that every 20 years. So when I was a baby in the 70s and then 1994, I only had one conscious incident, but I suspect that they may have been bothering me for much of the middle 1990s. I think they came for me in 95 as well. So I suspect there may have been a 4 year period and I was only like cognizant of one incident where I woke up where they couldn't keep me asleep because I made a mistake. So I think they come in 20 year cycles and then they do a 4 year rotation. That's what I think. That's just an opinion based on the schedule that they've used with me.
Well, you know, when I think about it, it actually works pretty well with my experience, too. I'm not going to get into that now, but it does. But go ahead.
All right. Well, if that resonates, that's fascinating to me.
Yeah, it does.
All right. So I, the very next week, I woke up in the middle of the night with a tall gray laying on top of me. And he wasn't really touching me. He was, and I have an illustration, and it's going to freak you out when you see it because it's so accurate. I did a good job. But I was.
Would you be able to show it on the show?
Yeah, I could probably call it up. Is there a way to put an image
on the screen? No, just send it to me. We'll put it in.
Oh, yeah, I could do that.
Okay, great. Let me make a note of that.
Yeah, I have lots of images I could show you, but this one is the one I'm using on the front cover of my memoir because it's just so unsettling. So he was on top of me, face to face, and he was propping himself up on the bed with his two hands to the right and left of my shoulders. And he was trying to get me to look directly into his eyes like this. And I was too intimidated to look him in the eyes. He wasn't clothed like the little ones. The tall one, he had elephant gray skin, but it was more like fine leather. But I was examining his shoulder because it was dark in the room, but there was illumination between the two of us, between our two chests. So there was light where I could see him and he could see me, but I couldn't see where the source of the light was coming from. It's as if like magic light. It was weird. But so I could see his face, his shoulders, his upper arms and his chest just by, you know, the position of my head. And so he was on top of me and I was too intimidated to look him in the eyes. So I was staring at his shoulder because, you know, how like if somebody more powerful than you and you're vulnerable, you just kind of like, you know, if you're a coward, you just kind of like cower. So I was cowering. I was staring at his shoulder and it noticed that I was examining his shoulder and I wanted to touch his shoulder and he knew that. And suddenly I could move my left arm. And he must have known I wasn't going to be violent. But so I moved my arm like between the tight spaces of our shoulders and I put my left hand on his right shoulder. And I could feel his clavicle. He had a clavicle, a collarbone with my left thumb. And then I was feeling him, the texture of the skin. And it was very sinewy, muscular, bony, like there was no subcutaneous fat in his body. I mean, if there was very little subcutaneous fat. I didn't feel.
Then this was, again, folks, a real experience because he's describing something that's never been described before, but it's extremely accurate. Go ahead.
All right. So after I felt his shoulder for a while, I realized he wasn't there to hurt me. So then I was calm enough to look him in the eyes. And when I looked him in the eyes, he moved his forehead to mine and he touched his forehead to mine. I was instantly asleep and we were in a dream environment and he was in the dream environment. And the three little grays that were standing on the right side of my bed, watching him on top of me, suddenly they were three little girls, blue-eyed, blonde-haired girls in identical dresses, and we were in what looked like a Bavarian village. We were standing on a cobblestone street that was slightly sloped, and 200 feet away, there was a Bavarian-style building with the cross-timbered architecture with the white stucco plaster between the timbers, and down the street, I could see there were more buildings of that style, and I'm like, are we in Germany? I mean, it looked like Germany, and there was a full moon, which was pretty amazing because there was actually a full moon that night. This was in, I got put it in my memoir, but I was looking at the tall gray, but this was a shorter tall gray. He was only like 5.5 feet tall. Other tall grays I've seen were like 7-8 feet tall, like really tall. And I've seen dozens of them before, but this one was a shorter one. And I call it a he because it just felt like a male energy. I mean, you can't see genitals on these guys, but I just got this male energy from it. And we had a conversation in this induced dream environment. And that was fascinating.
Well, tell us about it.
All right. So, I think he was there to find out how I knew that they were coming for me, because I put the sign on my wall. It must have startled the little grays. They must have been startled by my sign. Like, hey, what did we screw up? You know, what, how does he know? How the heck does he know? And so that must have alerted one of their superiors to come and check me out and probe my mind or whatever. But he was letting me ask questions. And so I asked him, well, what's your name? And he said, Sizzlick. And I said, Sizzlick, you know, I didn't know whether it was the Z came first or the L came first. And so I bent down and I was talking to little girls because I figured they couldn't hear his thoughts like I could. And I was speaking to them verbally in this dream environment in which we're communicating. And I said, he said his name is Sizzlick. And then I turned back to the tall gray and I asked him, are you from Zeta Reticuli? Because, you know, I read about that they're from Zeta Reticuli. And so I had to ask him, are you from Zeta Reticuli? And he said, yes. And I said, do you call it Serpo? Because I read that, you know, the name of the planet was Serpo. He said, no, we don't call it that. And I'm like, okay. But he didn't tell me what it is. He didn't tell me the name of their world. And so I bent down. And again, I talked to the three little girls who at the time I believed were little girls. But after you wake up, you realize, no, I was talking to the three little grays. And there he walked down.
Yeah.
So that was a screen memory within that dream. But I knew I was dreaming with this thing on top of me. And we had a short conversation like that. And then when I was done asking him questions and when he was done answering the questions, I turned back to the little girls, and the one in the middle little girl, looked up at me square in the eyes and said, you know, you're nice. We were told you would be mean. And before I could ask what that meant, my consciousness went black. I wasn't even in a REM stage of sleep anymore. I just went black. And then I ended up waking up and they were gone. They weren't in my bedroom anymore. And that was the second time I had an encounter that I remembered. But it gets so much stranger, so much more graphic, so much more visceral, some of my future encounters. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm just processing. And there's so much here that comports with things that I know and have experienced myself, and more than I have experienced in many ways. Let's go a little deeper.
Okay.
You mentioned some things that were much stranger. I think this is the ideal place for you to go there. This show, I mean.
Okay.
A lot of people who watch this show or listen to this show have been in that much stranger space.
What aspect do you want to go deeper with?
I don't know. I don't know your story, so you have to choose.
Well, I just sat there on the edge of my bed just processing that the communication we had. I don't know why I had to be asleep for our interview, you know, me and Sizzlick. But I thought, wow, it sounds like a Polish name.
Because they couldn't take you into the next frequency, which is the dream frequency, and that's how they would communicate. They can't communicate in this frequency very well at all.
Well,
let's go to another experience.
Okay.
Much stranger things have happened.
Yeah, I had a string every 4 to 6 weeks for the next 4 years, I had a string of experiences, and I could just like start rattling them off, or I could give you like the big ones.
Give us one big one, because I think, you know, I don't want to overwhelm my audience or myself.
Okay.
And I think, you know, you're writing a memoir, which you must write. You absolutely must write. I promise to write a foreword to it if you do.
I would love that. I was going to ask you, but I was afraid.
No, I will do it.
All right.
So go ahead.
One of the big ones was arm surgery. They did a surgery on my left arm, and it was extremely traumatic. I woke up from a black sleep because my left arm was in extreme pain. And I woke up, and the first thing I noticed, I was not in my bedroom. I was lying on my back on a metal table, pewter gray metal table, and gray walls, and only the immediate area where I was illuminated softly, and then beyond that, shadows. So I couldn't see anything, but I gathered that I was not home, like within the first second before I realized what was happening to me. And my left arm was killing me. And I looked down, and my arm ended just above the elbow. It was gone. My left arm was, and but there was no blood coming out of me. But I started to panic, like, where's my arm?
And yeah, that would be very concerning.
Right. So I couldn't turn my head to the right, but I turned my head to the left, and there was a metal cart about the same height of the table that I was laying on. And my arm was on the cart, and it was, but there was no blood. There was no blood under it, around it, on it. There were no like blood stains on the edge of the stump. It was just there. I could see some of the muscle tissue. I could see part of the humerus bone sticking out. And so it was right about here above the elbow where they cut it, right here. And I was just, but I was so overwhelmed, and I was in such pain. I lost consciousness as soon as I realized what was going on.
Yeah, that's very understandable.
But I was aware of movement to my right. I didn't see anybody. Now, I did an illustration of this surgery, and I put some grays in there for drama. But I didn't actually see any grays. I only saw that I was laying on a metal table in a dimly lit room with a metal cart next to me with my arm on it. And that's all I really saw. So I dramatized my illustration a little bit. Apologize for that. But there was movement to the right of me. So whoever, there was somebody in the room with me, whatever surgical room we were in. And I lost consciousness, and I woke up, and my arm was still killing me. But my arm was back. And so I sat up and I inspected my arm. I'm like, all right, where are the sutures? There were no sutures. There's no scarring of any kind, nothing. But my elbow was killing me. It was just and swollen. And I could only move it a little bit, but within an hour I couldn't move it at all. And my arm was frozen in a 90-degree angle for an entire month. And I had trouble driving my car. I had trouble applying shampoo on my head in the shower for a whole month. But what really sinks this in as a real experience for me, and not just like some elbow inflammation that just came randomly out of nowhere. The next 2 weeks they did follow-up visits. And that's uncharacteristic for them, because normally they come every 4 to 6 weeks, but they came the very next week, and I woke up and in a strange room. It felt, I believed I was in a hospital setting, but I know better now after, it happened, I wasn't in a hospital. I was somewhere else, but I was laying on, this time it wasn't a metal table. It was a bed. It was a kind of a cushioned bed with no sheets on it, but there was like a white canvas, like a soft white canvas tightly wrapped around the cushion I was laying on. So it was a very utilitarian type of bed. And someone was holding my hand, laying next to me. that I perceived at the time was a girl, but my visual memory remembers that was a small gray. And the small gray had a female energy about her, and she was holding my hand. And for I don't know how they did it, but they managed to extend my left arm out, and there was a tall gray leaning over the bed, inspecting my left arm, like moving his hands up and down over my elbow, checking it. And the tall gray was like distracting me from, or the small gray that was holding my hand was distracting me from the tall gray that was inspecting my arm. And I looked at her, and she was holding my hand. Like, was that to keep me calm? And she said to me, "Do you have anything you want to tell me?" And I was so confused because they have me in like in this entranced state, and they have a way of dialing down the volume on your nervous system. So
they sure do. I've had that experience too.
Right. So you can't feel as much. And I think there's a purpose to that. Now they can't dial down my visual sense. And as an art director, I think visually I record everything. You can't erase that from my mind, but they can lower the impact of a memory by squelching your nervous system and reducing your ability to sense things by touch, by smell. You know, they turn down the volume on your nervous system. That's the best way I can describe it. So she was holding my hand. She said, do you have something you want to tell me? And I was so confused with what was going on. I thought maybe this girl liked me or something, and I didn't know why she was holding my hand. And I said, "Well, I'm not married or anything," which was so embarrassing to me because, like, wait, it's a medical follow-up visit on my arm, and here I am, like, confused out of my mind, thinking this little person whose feet only came to my knees, so it was like the size of a child. Asking me if I have something I want to tell her. And so it was a bizarre experience, but I lost consciousness after she asked me that and after I replied to her. And I woke up at home and I noticed my arm suddenly had about 10% movement extra than it did the week before. And there was one more visit the very next week where I woke up in a standing position in a strange room. And there was a tall gray standing next to me, about 7 feet tall, and I was unsteady on my feet. So it was like motioning me to walk over to a railing that was on the wall. It was like a gray wall, the gray railing. They love gray. And so I was supposed to hang on to this railing to steady myself. And so once I got my steadiness and I was conscious but entranced, this tall gray grabs my shoulders, turns me toward him or her, and then starts moving its hands up and down my left arm over the elbow. I don't know what that was about, but it was like another follow-up visit on whatever they did to my arm.
And you never figured out what they did to your arm?
Well, they cut it off, but I think...
Well, I know that, but I mean, why? You never got a why out of it.
They may have taken bone marrow. They may have put something in the humerus bone inside the bone. So I might have an implant in my left arm deep in the bone, or they wanted to get like, take out a nice chunk of marrow. I'll regenerate it. It probably wouldn't hurt me to do that. But
well, that's where I think the pain came from. I was just going to say that I have a feeling this was a marrow extraction.
Yeah, it very well, because I think they also took a marrow out of my hip one time with a needle on another occasion. But I didn't have a conscious encounter. It was afterwards.
Well, we've come to the end of our time together on the show. And, you know, we could obviously talk for hours.
I have a lot more.
Well, come back. I'd love to. Yeah, great. So we'll do that in a hopefully... when your memoir is finished, and I'm encouraging you in a big way to do that. And if you want to publish it and run into any trouble, let me know. because I have my own publishing company. We could conceivably publish it.
All right. So I'd love for you to read it.
Yeah, I'd love to read it. And okay, Eric Nan Steele, what a remarkable journey we've been on with you today. And thank you for being so open. And I would be surprised if this journey wasn't being told with a fair degree of accuracy, because there are so many points in your story that fit with either my own story or other stories that I know and that are in the, like in the communion letters at Rice University. So remarkable. And let's go on down the road together.
I'd love to, and I appreciate this opportunity.
Sure. Well, okay, Eric, thank you so much for being with us on Dreamland, and we'll see you again soon.
Thank you, Whitley, very much.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.